Thomas, we're gonna talk about the writing process today. I'm really happy for the opportunity to do this. I think it'd be very meaningful to start off talking about how you think about the purpose of academic writing. What are we trying to do when we do academic writing?
Yeah. So the certainly the most important thing about academic writing is that you are writing down something you know. It's about knowledge. You're not writing your opinions necessarily, although we'll talk about that, about your opinions do matter. But you're not writing just to write. You're writing down something that you know. And you're writing it down for the purpose of discussing it with other knowledgeable people. So one thing that I always remind scholars and students is that they should get used to the idea that what they're doing is presenting something that they think is true with the aim of letting somebody else who knows something about the subject criticize them, show them that they're wrong. A really strong way of putting this is to say you are explaining something to somebody who is qualified to tell you that you're wrong. That's a very strong way of putting it. So you're not explaining it to somebody who should believe you because you're the expert. You're explaining it to them to somebody who is your intellectual equal so that they can give you feedback and correct you where you've made a mistake, challenge you where they think something else. Sometimes you're right, but the challenge itself is useful. So that's really what academic writing is all about. It's writing down something you know for the purpose of discussing it with other knowledgeable people. It's part of a conversation of among knowledgeable people.
I think that term, the idea of a conversation, gets kind of thrown around a lot. And at least for me, it took a long time to figure out what that actually meant. Could you elaborate that a little bit?
Sure.
I'm thinking specifically in the context of a bachelor's program.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that we're writing something for it to be part of a conversation. What kind of conversation is that, and who's part of it, and how should we think about what they're talking about?
Right. So it's a conversation among all the people who take a serious interest in a certain subject, who've devoted time to studying it. So not people who are merely entertained by these ideas, but people who have sacrificed some of their effort, their time, their energy, taking time away from other things to really get this thing right. So they are, we might say they are curious at a higher level than ordinary people. They're not just idly curious, they're intently curious. And so these are the people that are then talking about this issue, they're conversing about it. And the conversation is very much a back and forth kind of, you should imagine an ordinary kind of conversation. You should imagine that the conversation was ongoing before you arrived. And that really it was ongoing before any of the people you observe participating in the conversation arrive. So that it's kind of, some people talk about the conversation of humankind, that it's a cultural conversation about these subjects. So it has a long tradition in history, and it will keep going long after you start participating in it. That's an important feature of the conversation.
Okay, great. So you talk about how, as you're contributing to that conversation in writing, you're writing down something that you know. Could you elaborate how you think about what it means to know something?
Yeah.
Because this is going to be important as we kind of progress into how you think about writing in general.
Yeah, it's very important to get clear about what we mean at a university when we say somebody's knowledgeable or somebody knows something. One thing I like to really emphasize is the able in knowledgeable. So it's not a matter of having knowledge so much as being able to know something, having a set of intellectual competences that allows you to know something. And in a very specialized society that we live in, This knowledge will be, you'll be better at knowing some things than other things, right? So in this course, you might be better at knowing something about innovation. In another course, you might be better at knowing something about finance. If you were taking physics or medicine, you would become better at knowing something about those subjects. So it's not, it's very discipline specific in that sense. So that's the first thing to keep in mind, is that it's a competence. And then there are really three major competences that I like to emphasize when we talk about knowing something at a university or knowing something academically, which is different from knowing something in a business, knowing something even in a hospital, in a very technical thing. So if you're at a university, there are three things you should really keep in mind, and you should... What I like to say is you shouldn't tell yourself or anybody else that you know something until you yourself know that you can do these three different kinds of things. There's sort of three sets of skills. And roughly speaking, we can think of the first set as a philosophical set of skills, and then we can think of the second set as a rhetorical set of skills, and the third set as a literary set of skills. So there is a kind of, you might call it a cognitive or mental component to this. It's the philosophical part. Then there's a linguistic or communicative, language-oriented, social component. And then there's a directly literary, where it's really about, are you, you know, how good are you at writing about it, which is one of the things we'll, of course, be talking a lot about. Roughly speaking, you could say you don't want to say you know something until you are able to make up your mind about it, speak about it, and write it down. So those are really the three things. You want to have the ability to make up your mind, the ability to speak intelligently, obviously, about it, and the ability to write it down. So let's go, well, I guess we can go through those one at a time. Philosophers will normally begin the conversation about what knowledge is. They won't end it there, but they'll begin with the idea that knowledge is justified true belief. So they will say, if you want to know something, you have to form a belief about it. This is the act of making up your mind. Obviously, it's not good enough to form just any old belief. It should be a true belief. Most people, hopefully, have had the experience of having made up their mind about something, and it turns out to be false. That experience is really the basis of understanding what truth is. Right? That disappointment of thinking I knew what was going on, and then discovering that that was not what was going on, is the opposite of truth. Right? So you have a true belief when what you made up your mind about somehow corresponds to or aligns with or is satisfied by what's going on in the world. So think about that. And we can obviously get way too philosophical about whether or not that could ever happen. But like I say, because we've all had this everyday experience of being not right, we have a sense of what it would mean to be right. And certainly when we know something, we want to make sure we're believing true things. And then we want to make sure that we know why we believe it, so that we have a justification for believing it, and that that justification is, and we may talk about this in other contexts as well, that that justification is warranted in some way, which is to say that other people would accept it as a good explanation. And so my favorite example of this is, and we can sort of share this experience, is that people might have prejudices against bearded men because they are obviously hiding something. And so we might get into situations where people don't trust us. Now, it's possible, of course, to meet a bearded man that is also untrustworthy. So if I have this prejudice against a bearded man, and then it happens to be somebody who is untrustworthy, then I may make up my mind about him on the basis of this prejudice, and it may be a true belief. But the whole point of the justification part of the definition is that if somebody then asks me, why don't you trust him? And I say, well, he has a beard, can't you see? Then most people will say, well, that kind of undermines your argument for believing this. It's not a good reason to believe. So it's not a justification. So I usually emphasize those things. You should, if you want to know something, make up your mind about it. Try to make sure it's true, right? And know why you believe it in such a way that that explanation, that argument for believing it, is a common sense, strong one, one that other people would accept.
If I was going to riff a little bit on that, the part about justification, I would say, especially in the context of a course on innovation, we're dealing with something that is ideologically saturated. It's filled with ideas. So people sometimes come in saying something that's true, but they're justifying it for the wrong reason, right? They're justifying it in the wrong way. They think it's important for something that is, for some kind of reason, which has no real backing in the kind of truth that we would accept in the university. And I think that's kind of an interesting situation to come into pedagogically, and especially for students when they find out that what they thought was, I mean, sometimes it's easy, right? When people come in with something that they think is true, which is just wrong, right? Then you can kind of have your mind changed, and that's fantastic. That's what we do in university, right? We disappoint people's opinion sometimes by saying what you think is true is not true, and that's the value of the university, I think, more than anything, is people in academia change their mind much more than people elsewhere. And I think that's what a university does well.
That's how it should be, yeah.
That's how it should be, right? When the facts change, I change my mind.
Yep.
And there's and lots of people have this pretense of knowing, right? They think they know something and they cling on to it and it doesn't hold up, and then they should, at least in an academic setting, forego it.
Right.
They should do that in society at large. But that's kind of, that's one part of it. But the more interesting thing is actually when people know something that, and it's true, but it's not justified. And that's kind of and that happens so often when people, because, I mean, lots of what circulates about innovation is, it's not decidedly wrong, right? People get the headline.
Yep.
But they don't get the argument. And I think that's kind of an interesting nuance in when you talk about the nature of knowledge, right? It's justified and true.
Yeah, I think you're pointing out two really, really important things about the difference between academic knowledge and common sense, everyday social knowledge, the sort of thing that you get in newspapers, the sort of thing that politicians and managers actually refer to when they're justifying their ideas or their policies and programs and this kind of thing. While at university, remember that it's a nice protected space in which you are allowed to make mistakes. You really have a right to be wrong, and you have a right to be wrong for quite a long time. And the difference that you're pointing out is really, really important, because it's actually better to be wrong with a good justification for the purpose of doing your assignments, for the purpose of having this conversation that we talked about, than to be right, to happen to have the right idea, but with arguments that don't support a useful conversation, or that don't even open up for conversation. Right? So it's much better to be wrong but justified than it is to be right but not justified in an academic setting. I think that's a very, very important point to make, is that the conversation goes on the reasons for knowing as much, if not more, than the actual belief that you hold. So I think that's quite important.
Which I think kind of brings us nicely back to this idea, if you want to discuss, you want to, as you're writing, you want to make your beliefs open to discussion.
Right.
Want to make them transparent. Why is it that you think, what is it you think is true, and why do you think it's true? And so I'd like you to get very practical on it and have you talk a little bit about what academic writing then is made of in such a way that that we can do this, that we can discuss what we know and believe.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we agree that to know something you have to make up your mind about it, make sure you have your arguments in order, and that you are able to have an intelligent conversation about it with these other knowledgeable people, if we agree about that, then we have to ask ourselves, well, how does writing both express the same competence of knowing? So how does the stuff that I'm writing actually demonstrate that even though you're not talking to me right now, we could be having an interesting argument about the justifications you have for knowing something. The justifications you have for believing something. How does writing do that? And the definition that I always propose to people is that they never think of their knowledge as separate from their ability to compose coherent prose paragraphs. So you should say to yourself, knowledge is in part the ability to compose a coherent prose paragraph about something. And then we can immediately ask, well, what do I mean by a coherent prose paragraph? That's an obvious question. And the answer to that question is formal and simple. And of course, there's exceptions. But let's just start with a simple kind of framework. Think of a paragraph as being at least 6 sentences long and at most 200 words. So it's about half a page or 3/4 of a page. Usually has like a tab indent at the beginning or a new line at least. So it's a nice solid block of prose. Pretty much every article and book that you will be asked to read will have plenty of examples of what a paragraph is. And not all texts will consist only of these paragraphs. Some will have little 3-sentence fragments here and there. But you'll always be able to find nice examples of these blocks of text. And think of knowing something as the ability to make one of these, right? If you look closely at a well-formed prose paragraph in an academic text, you'll notice that there's usually one sentence that expresses the kind of point of the paragraph, that expresses the central claim of the paragraph, and the rest of the paragraph is organized around that. So when you say that a paragraph always says one thing, and then it supports, elaborates, or defends it. So there's really 3 different things that a paragraph can do with this one central theme that it expresses. And I would very much, I mean, you can always, as you get more advanced, you'll have more stylistic flourish and you'll have more ways of doing things, make it a little more interesting. But at the beginning, when you're learning how to write these paragraphs, you should really say, well, there should be a sentence in the paragraph. That's a nice, simple, declarative sentence. It doesn't have to be the first sentence. It doesn't have to be the last sentence. It can technically appear anywhere. Often at the beginning, it's easiest just to make it the first sentence or the last sentence. There's a nice, simple, declarative sentence, and it says something that you have made up your mind about. This is true. It can be true about something you've read, so it can be true about a text. It can be true about a company. It can be true about a management practice. Right? It can be true about world history, but it's something that you have decided from your reading and the class conversations you've been involved in. You've decided this is true. All right. Now, if you've just made up your mind that it's true and you think you know it, then you also have a justification for it. And it's the justification you then use to construct the rest of the paragraph. So how do you decide whether or not you should support, elaborate, or defend the central claim of the paragraph? And this is where it's going to, we haven't talked about this yet, but this is where it's going to get very important to think about your reader. All right, so who is the person that you are having the conversation with? Who are the other knowledgeable people? The people, like I said earlier, who are qualified to tell you that you're wrong? Who are these people? And it's tempting when we do academic writing to think of the other knowledgeable people as your examiners, your teachers, your external examiners, this kind of thing. And perhaps if we're really sophisticated about it, the community that they represent, which would be all the other teachers, instructors, researchers, scholars in the field. That temptation is one that I really encourage students to just try to get rid of right at the beginning. Remember that you're not communicating anything of interest to your examiner. Your teacher is so much more familiar with this material than you are, presumably, than you are. And so you're not going to communicate directly with the teacher. What you're going to do is present something to the teacher that the teacher can evaluate in terms of the competence to discuss a subject matter with other knowledgeable people, which say intellectual equals. Right? So what is an intellectual equal? With somebody who has about the same amount of experience as you, roughly the same amount of raw intelligence, and this is important, the same frame of reference, which means has read the same required reading that you have read, for example, for the course that you're submitting the assignment in, right? So you should always think about your ability to participate in this conversation as relative to that course that you're participating in. So if you want to really get a good image of your reader, imagine the most serious, the most intelligent, the most studious of your fellow students. And that could be you. It could be the people you hang out with. But it could also just be a kind of construct, kind of like you decide, well, what would a really serious student look like, do with this material? What would they? How would they engage with this material? And then try to communicate your writing to them. The reason that you want to do that is that it's somebody that you can identify with, right? It's somebody whose mind you can get into. And once you've done that, you then are in a position to decide how to write your paragraphs. Because if you've decided something is true, so you've decided this is something I'm going to say in response to whatever the difficulty is that I have been given in the paragraph, in the assignment. So I've been given an assignment. Now I'm going to say this is true in the assignment. Then I should ask myself, what does my reader find difficult about the key sentence? What is it in the key sentence that the reader will have to do some work with, right? And what kind of work will that be? And so just ask yourself, will the reader find it hard to believe? Will the reader find it hard to understand? Or will the reader find it hard to agree with? Those are three very different difficulties. If the reader would find it hard to believe, the natural thing to do is to make the claim more believable by providing evidence. Right? So we assume that the reader is going to say, that sounds hard to believe, so I need some evidence. And then you provide, in the paragraph, you provide evidence for the truth of this claim. If the reader would find it hard to understand, on the other hand, you're going to have to do something different. You're going to have to explain what you mean, define your terms. There's a special case of finding it hard to understand, which is that the reader actually recognizes the claim you're making because it makes use of concepts from a theory that you are familiar with and that the reader is also familiar with. So the reader will completely understand that you're saying this, but because the reader understands the theory, the reader also knows that you have to specify the parameters under which you're applying these concepts, right? So you have to say a little more about exactly what you mean, given that you've used this concept. So that's certainly but that's the second one. And then there's the last and probably the most interesting situation you can be in, which is you made up your mind about something, you want to say it. And you, like for example, Steve Jobs was not very good at managing innovation, right? Now, then you realize, well, given the class conversations we've had about Steve Jobs, and how he was able to manage the innovation process at Apple, it's my sense that my classmates think he was brilliant at it, right? So I'm going to have to defend this claim. I'm going to have to I'm going to have to take apart the justifications that they have for believing what they believe, and I'm going to have to manage this disagreement in some way. And it's important to emphasize that if you are managing a disagreement with your reader, you're not necessarily winning an argument. You're not trying to persuade them that you're right. What you're doing is you're acknowledging that what you're saying is controversial, and you are trying to make your disagreement a constructive part of the conversation rather than expecting that the reader will necessarily agree with you by the time they've read the paragraph. I mean, that's a pretty high bar to set for your writing. So it's just a question of acknowledging and positioning your argument in a disagreement.
So I'd like to dwell on each of those a little bit in turn. And if we start off with this idea of providing evidence. Could you elaborate that? What would constitute evidence in kind of the context of like students starting out studying a topic? What would constitute evidence for a claim?
Yeah, this obviously depends on the claim. So if you have been given, one of the things that you're likely to have happen is you will be given some case material, for example, and you are going to make some claims about what is happening in a particular practice, or you're going to make some claims about, because this will also happen, that a business leader a business leader or an organization theorist even might get an interview with them or some sort of discussion with them. And you have to say, you have to attribute to them an opinion or a belief or an attitude or a set of values. And of course, the evidence for that will be whatever they said. So later on, when you do your own firsthand empirical studies and collect your own data, you'll be doing interviews with people. And you will again attribute attitudes, opinions, beliefs, and values to these people. And then your evidence for that will be the things they said in their interviews. Likewise, if you want to say that a certain company has grown exponentially over the last 5 years, you will need evidence. And usually you'll find those in various company reports. There's a lot of databases in the library that will help you with this. And so you would look there, or you could look at their annual reports and so forth. Sometimes, depending on how famous the company is, there'll be some news coverage that you can use, or even whole nonfiction book-length treatments of a certain company, its rise and fall or whatever, right? So there'll be that kind of evidence. Then there's a special case of evidence as well, which is if you are going to say that something is true about a theory, then your evidence will be the sources you use. So you'll be using the scientific literature. Some of that will be presented, obviously, in your required reading, but you can also find your own in the library. It'll be your readings. It will be sources that tell you something about empirical reality. There will be times when it will also be your own experience. But in science, most of the time we'll say, well, if you're going to base your argument on personal experience, on your own experience, sorry, it shouldn't be personal experience, right? It should be methodologically generated experience, or what we call data, right?
Okay. So I think that's just important as you're trying to form, I mean, a lot of what we do in this course is going to be about forming a theoretical opinion about things, because we encounter the world, so to speak, in our cases, but we don't encounter the world in our theoretical readings. So we'll say something like, there's a trade-off between being innovative and being efficient. We'll say that, and the way to provide evidence for that is not to go out and look for the trade-off in the world, it's to...
Right.
The shorthand is just to quote the references that we provide in the course.
Exactly. And you raise a really good point there, because one could easily imagine writing a key sentence that says there's a trade-off between innovation and efficiency. And then saying, for example, in the 1980s, Microsoft did such and such and such, right? And then we say, well, is that evidence? If it's just an example, you could say it's not really evidence, because maybe Microsoft is an outlier case, maybe it's not a good example of this, right? Or maybe it's not a generalizable example of this. So it's not really, properly speaking, evidence, because you haven't provided anything you can generalize from. But what it is an example, so it's elaboration. So what you've really done is you've said to yourself, I'm going to explain to the reader what I mean by the trade-off by providing an example. I'm not going to expect my reader to believe any more than they did before that there's this trade-off, but I will imagine that they now understand better at least what I mean by this trade-off. if I really want to get them to believe it, if I think that's the issue, if I think the reader's going to have a hard time believing it, I would have to provide different kinds of evidence. For example, the evidence of scientific studies that have really studied this, three different studies over the last two decades have shown this again and again. The result has replicated and all this kind of stuff, right?
So you brought up elaboration, and you talk about how elaborating an argument can also be about clarifying what you actually mean. And I think some of the terms that we're going to use, precisely the clarification, is really important. Mm-hmm. Innovation, as we talked about, is filled with jargon and ideology, and everybody is talking about disruption. And something that I try to push in the class that we'll get to, where we talk about disruption, is this idea that disruption actually means something tremendously specific. And if we clarify what we mean, we're going to see that it doesn't occur very often.
Right.
It's going to be a much, much more limited phenomenon it's clearly not something that every entrepreneur is doing. It's something that it's a very particular playbook for doing entrepreneurship.
Right.
And it is a very particular set of reasons why it can have the effects that it has because of clarifying it. So this, and that's just one thing. And the other thing is, sometimes we use these terms that can be used in an everyday sense. And the same term, if you, for instance, you can exploit all kinds of things, right? You can, workers get exploited all the time.
Right.
It can take any number of forms. But if you use it, if you put March 1991 after the term exploitation, then suddenly it takes on a very specific meaning. Then it becomes about a particular mode of organizational learning.
Yeah.
And that kind of nuance, saying when are you using this term in like a general sense and when are you using it in a very specific sense, becomes really important.
Yes. Yeah, so it would be like, you wouldn't want to make the mistake of saying without any qualification, March was in favor of exploitation. Because that has connotations that we don't want. So we want to make sure we're using the words in a technical sense, right?
And of course, depending on your reader, I think that was just important. If you say explore to a community of people who have read March and take some of what he says for granted, then saying exploration in an offhand manner is going to generate misunderstandings, because people might reasonably have an expectation that are you using that in a technical sense or in just an everyday sense?
Yep.
So that becomes the audience in a very...
Exactly.
The audience shapes what it's viable to say.
And if I can then just specify again and emphasize that the audience here is your fellow students, and so you're really, it's a good exercise to just keep imagining, what do my fellow students mean with words like exploration, exploitation, and just be, and be kind of impressed by the fact that before this course started, maybe we had a different sense of those words, and now we've actually learned what these words mean in a specific way. We thought they had some meanings before, of course, but now we know what they mean to March, right? And we can now have a conversation where these specific meanings are made use of. Right?
So, finally, this idea of defending a claim is, of course, really is something that is really crucial to this, what we just talked about, disappointing your reader's opinions, or disappointing your reader's knowledge, telling them something that, and swaying their belief a little bit. So could you talk a little bit about there's an idea when you talk about defending that you're saying something is controversial, and then you're trying to bring people to think about what you just said controversially as being a little less controversial. Is that a fair way to think about it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you... I mean, there's obviously people who enjoy controversy, who kind of get a kick out of being in opposition to things. And certainly in academia, there's room for that, but controversy should never be seen as a virtue in its own right or a value in its own right. It's kind of like, I guess, kind of like disruption should perhaps not be seen as necessarily a virtue, right? But it is certainly part of the business as you, as part of what we do, right, is to have controversy. So we have to not be afraid of it, is the first and important thing. We have to remember that academic knowledge is not just learning the truth. It's not just learning what the orthodoxy is. It is making up your mind. It's holding an opinion that is sometimes in tension with other opinions. One image I like to use of this is the daughter of the robber's daughter, Ronja, from the Scandinavian literature. Ronja Rövardalen. Yes. Who is is becoming a young girl, and she now has reached the age where she is going to be put under her own surveillance, her own reconnaissance. So she's going to go out into the forest, and she's going to go and do various things and learn what life's about. And so her father says, you have to be very careful down by the river. Beware of the river, right? And beware of the abyss of doom, which is a dangerous place, obviously. That wouldn't be called that. And so what does she do? Does she stay away from the river? Does she stay away from the abyss of doom? No, she goes right down to the river and is very careful there. She takes care. She goes right up to the abyss. In fact, she jumps over the abyss several times very carefully to practice care in engaging with these dangers, right? And that's really what I would encourage people to do in the case of disagreement and controversy, is you really have to say, it's not something I'm going to be afraid of, it's something I'm going to learn how to manage. So if I have an opinion that I think other people will disagree with, that's exactly something I should be expressing. I, of course, should be open to the idea that I'm wrong, right? But I should express why I think the way I do, and why I think the reasons that are normally offered for the opposite are false. So you should really try to engage with these things in a good-natured and somewhat brave manner.
And I think we're going to have a really lovely example of that, because I talk about this trade-off between exploration and exploitation, and between innovation and effectiveness. And as we get a little later in the course, there'll be one session where we explicitly see people defending in very different ways the claim that that trade-off is not generally true. Right. So that's kind of an interesting occasion to watch out for this.
Right.
And it's called Perspectives on the Productivity Dilemma. Right. So the productivity dilemma is this idea that there's a trade-off. And then you have six different really knowledgeable people who in different ways have tried to dismantle this idea that there is a trade-off. And it's just, and that's kind of an interesting occasion to see how this plays out.
Right.
This effort to respectfully disagree.
Yes.
And that's a really valuable skill for people to build up, right? And to practice justifying in different ways.
Exactly. And if you have six different people that hold different views on the same thing, you can't imagine that your reading and learning process is going to be first agreeing with one of them, then agreeing with the other one, then agreeing with the next one, then agreeing. You can't just change your mind six times. That's not learning, right? You have to be exposing yourself to arguments and then letting them change some of your mind, but some of it has to be you thinking that they are wrong for a while, right? And it's that's a great example of for when you should write down the disagreement that you have with somebody, because it'll make things clear to you.
And yes, and precisely, it's great because they all agree on the top level, right? They all have this idea that the productivity dilemma is not that much of a dilemma as a general rule, but they justify that in very different ways and talk about very specific applications. Okay, so we'll put that a little bit aside. I'd like to circle back to this, because I don't think you can say it enough, really, that academic writing is made up of a series of paragraphs, that each have this about half page length, 200 yep. words, and six sentences. Why does it look like that?
That's a good question. How did academic writing end up being composed into paragraphs? The reasons are probably somewhat just historical. They're not really arbitrary because it does actually, there's a kind of evolutionary thing. So paragraphs came to have the features they have by a kind of evolutionary process, by selection. Right? One of the things to keep in mind is that if you keep within those at least six sentences and most 200 words, you're creating what is about a minute's worth of reading experience. So you're building a moment for your reader that lasts about a minute. And in that minute, something should happen. Namely, the reader should be become aware of what you think and how you know. That's really the two things that that paragraph is doing. So what's happened is that we've discovered that from the point of view of a reader's attention, this moment, which takes about a minute, is kind of a useful cognitive state to be in for the reader. And then the reader relaxes and moves on to the next minute of their attention in which you can tell them something else. If you just keep going and going and going across five pages without really marking this moment in which the reader themselves gets to make up their mind about what you're trying to say and whether or not your justifications for it is good, then you are losing the reader. It's hard to. So it's a service to the reader, and it creates a kind of mutual affordance is a good word that we use for this. You can ask yourself, how can a mosquito land on the surface of a lake? Right. Well, and why can't we? Like if the surface of the lake is the kind of thing you can land on if you're a mosquito, but not if you're a person or a bear. And of course, the reason for that is that there's been a mutual evolution, as it were, right? The mosquito has evolved into an environment where the water has had a certain set of features and the mosquitoes had a certain set of features, and then that has been useful to the mosquito. The same is true of the paragraph and our attention. So our attention has been shaped over many, many years. And so for that reason, this paragraph, which sort of plays on our biological dispositions, but certainly also on our cultural dispositions to read. So that's why we talk about paragraphs in this way, is that they just are the thing we're used to as academics. So that it's like, why do we use English? Because it's the thing that everybody is able to make use of, right?
So restate your approach, right? I mean, you talk about these 200 words, mm-hmm. 1 minute reading experiences, composed of a key sentence and then a set of supporting sentences. Could you talk about that in a little bit more of a detail? Like what that key sentence, what is it that it does? And then how?
Right. Yeah. No, I understand what you're saying. I mean, think about a key sentence that says there were three important historical epochs in the history of innovation. Right? A claim like that. Well, in that sentence, there's already the structure of the paragraph because you've said there's three of something. So you will probably end up writing two sentences about the first. Two sentences about the second, two sentences about the third.
Incidentally, we'll talk about that in the future of innovation. There's
right.
a case before industrialization, then there's industrialization, economies right. of scale, changing the nature of how innovation gets done, and then there's an emergent, the future of innovation
right.
coming up.
Yeah. And it makes perfect sense to any sort of historical view like that. Pre-industrial, industrial, post-industrial, anything like that, right? Immediately gives you a structure for the paragraph, and the reader is predisposed. There's going to be three. I'm going to look for the three. So in this minute, you have three deliverables, as it were, right? So that's certainly one way of doing it. Sometimes you'll say there are several things to consider when thinking about, right? And several is a little vaguer than this, right? But maybe there'll then be one sentence for each of seven things or something, right? So there is that kind of structure. There will be other ones where you say it is very important, or this has been crucial, there has been a dramatic growth in something. And of course, if you're going to say there's been a dramatic growth in something, then your paragraph's task is now going to be to say there was a time when there wasn't very much of it, and then something happened, and now there's lots of it. And you're going to have to explain that. You're going to have to come up with those kinds of... So within the key sentence, you'll find much of the structure of the rest of the paragraph. There's a trade-off. If there's a trade-off between two things, you're probably going to have to write about the cost of one thing, the cost of the other thing, right? And so then how you...
scarce resources to juggle between.
Exactly, yeah.
So you have a particular point of view on how you should go about writing down these paragraphs.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us about this?
Right down at the physical level.
The process of producing paragraphs.
Yeah. So if you want to get good at writing paragraphs, you have to not... It's very important, and people will sometimes use the metaphor of the blank page. They'll say, don't ever start with a blank page. There's a sense in which that doesn't really matter. A blank page, if it scares you, then don't start with a blank page. That's fine, right? But it's not the blankness of the page that's the problem. The problem is the openness of the writing problem you've set yourself. So it's very hard to write if you decide tomorrow I'm going to write the assignment. Tomorrow I'm going to write a first draft. If you make a very vague statement about that you're going to write, then you will have a hard time figuring out what it is you're supposed to be doing, actually. Right. So what I always encourage people to do is to decide on one thing that they know the day before, and that you express that in a key sentence. You always do this at the end of the day when you are not going to make up your mind about any more justified true beliefs. Right. So you've learned everything you're going to learn today. And so now you just take 5 minutes and you decide about one thing you know. A really good idea here is not to pick something you learned today, but to pick something you knew already last week. So you're drawing from a store of pretty stable knowledge, right? So here's something you know, and then you say, I'm going to write about this tomorrow. For some people, it's the hard part, is not thinking about it from then on. So now you have to... do something else. Go see a movie, make dinner, whatever, hang out with your friends. Then early to bed, of course, early to rise, and then you sit down and you write this paragraph. The writing of the paragraph should happen at a specific moment, set in advance. So you decide, I'm going to write at 8 o'clock, and then give yourself a specific amount of time. My recommendation is to use 27 or 18 minutes. And to hold that time exactly. So spend exactly 18 or exactly 27 minutes, decided in advance which of those two it is. Then after you're done, after the 18 minutes or 27 minutes are over...
If I can just interrupt you. When you say that, 27 or 18 minutes, you mean that as in set a timer?
Yes. Some people need to set a timer because they need to be reminded when the time is over. But what I mean is set a start time, and 18 minutes later or 27 minutes later, stop, right? The reason that that's an important distinction to make is that if I usually recommend that if you end up starting 3 minutes late, you should still stop 27 minutes after 8, not 27 minutes after you started. And there are little training reasons for that. But so I don't necessarily mean set a timer. I mean set a time and hold to that time. The first thing you do, of course, is you type the key sentence that you came up with yesterday. So you just physically type that sentence. And this solves your blank page problem, even if you started with a blank page. So now you have that sentence, and then you do your, you reflect. You say, well, what will my reader find difficult with this? Sometimes you're just reminding yourself because you already knew this yesterday. Other times, this is what you're coming up with. And you say, oh, they'll have a hard time understanding it or believing it or agreeing with it. And then you go to work, right? You spend the time constructing a minute of reading experience that will deliver the key sentence. This leaves you all kinds of choices. You can move the key sentence around. You can even, in many cases, you'll sharpen the key sentence or you'll broaden it in some cases. You'll say, well, this is too specific. But the very, very important thing is not to show up to the writing session with an idea that you aren't sure you know, right? So you're not, and this is a part of my advice to writers that is sometimes different from what other writing instructors say, which is I do not believe you should use your writing to discover what you know. I believe you should use your writing primarily to present what you know to other knowledgeable people for the purpose of having a conversation with them about it, right? For the purpose of opening yourself to their criticism so that you aren't in doubt about whether or not you know, or you're at least in as little doubt as possible about whether or not you know when you sit there writing. Because what that will do is it will let you focus on the writing.
So this is the approach that I use and have used since my PhD, basically. Mm-hmm. And if you read my PhD, you will see that it's composed very, like, militaristically, almost, right, of 200-word paragraphs. But and in my experience, I like what you say about the blank page can be intimidating. And if you can just get over that by knowing in advance this is a key sentence, then you're helped out a lot. What I find is that it's not just about getting rid of the openness of writing. The writing is helpful. It's also actually getting rid of the blankness of your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, in my experience, people will say, and I get this even in master students who come in and say, and then I'm going to write something about this. And that's really difficult, right? Because they haven't made up their mind. What I find is happens is when I write down, indeed, when I go home or when my workday finishes, I write down, this is what I'm going to write about, right? This is the sentence that I'm going to support. Then I don't think about it, but it's latently there in my mind. And it means that when I sit down in the morning, it's much clearer for me what I'm going to do with that key sentence than when I write it down. Because it just kind of,
yep,
your subconscious works at it.
You say you're subconscious, but it's actually just you're unconscious. I firmly believe that it's that there is a process that is not conscious that you have to make sure that you let do much of the work of writing and much of the work of knowing. Right. One of the things we have to remember is that if you're a knowledgeable person, then you are that. Even when you're not talking about other knowledgeable people, right? Even when you're asleep, right? Even when you are walking down the street and something falls on your head and you get knocked out and you're completely unconscious, when you wake up, unless there's been some serious damage, you're still a knowledgeable person about the areas of expertise that you're in, right? So it's very, very important to keep that in mind, that being knowledgeable is more a disposition to be able to engage in a conversation than it is a conscious state of mind, right?
And so just as from the user perspective, I find these things just help people become better, like happier writers.
Mm-hmm.
They also help you get better, but just that part of just saying, letting so much of the work get done by your unconscious mind.
Right.
That's fantastic, right? That you don't have to do all that work in the writing moment is a relief, right? Because writing is hard for lots of people, and it's a struggle because they're doing it all while they're there, and they don't let their unconscious do anything. I think that's one part of it. I think also the delimitation of the writing task is really helpful, right? Sometimes you see people, they just struggle at the keyboard, and they're just there for so long, and they keep writing, and something that I found helpful, and I'd like you to elaborate that a little bit, is the idea of saying, set yourself the time and then stop.
Yes.
Like, don't spend more time. Come back and redo it.
Yep.
Could you elaborate a little bit on your thoughts
yeah.
about that?
I mean, that comes from everything that we know about becoming good at anything else, getting into shape, learning how to play musical instruments and so forth, right? You don't want to keep practicing after the point at which you're just not getting any better because you're too tired, right? For some reason, we don't acknowledge that enough when it comes to writing. We don't acknowledge that it's actually exhausting to sit there for 27 minutes trying to say one thing and to express it in the with the best possible arguments you have. That is an effort that you make, and it requires that you relax, you release yourself from that task at some point. So if you sit down and concentrate for 18 or 27 minutes, knowing that at some arbitrary time in the future that's going to stop, you're going to make much better use of that time. A great example of this is, right now you're watching an interview or listening to a podcast. You have probably checked how long this video or podcast is before you started it. You may even have made some decisions about, this is too long, so I'm only going to listen to it for 15 minutes, and then I'm going to go do something else, right? That is helping you pay attention, right? It is if you show up to, this is also true of class, right? If you attend a class where the lecturer is known for not sticking to the breaks or the end times or whatever, then you have a harder time paying attention than to a lecture that says, this is going to take 45 minutes, then we'll take a 10-minute break, then we'll go on with the next, right? Because you know what to expect. If you can trust that the person will stop, right, it's much easier to take. You can take this even further. in later conversations, we'll talk about training or using each other to become better. And so if you're going to listen to somebody else criticize you, for example, it's a very good idea to set a time limit on that, because it makes it much easier to receive criticism if you know the person isn't just going to keep coming up with more things that are wrong with what you've done. Right? If you know, I'm going to just need to sit here for 10 minutes and listen to what this person thinks about what I've written, it's much easier than, I'm going to listen to everything this person can think of. Maybe it'll take an hour, and all I'm going to do is receive criticism. Right? So it's this idea of knowing how long it's going to take is very important. There is a reason that sporting matches, boxing fights, and football matches and so forth, all have predetermined time limits on things so that the athletes can measure out their energy, so they know how much they have to, they get used to that moment, right?
So, just to recap, right? You say, write down the key sentence the day before. Show up. Half of life is showing up.
Mm-hmm.
Show up, spend 27 or 18 minutes just writing, not doing anything else. I think that's actually important.
Yeah.
If people have it open-ended, then it's easy to go on Facebook or whatever.
Yes.
Right? But say that you will spend 27 or 18 minutes. And then you say that they should read what they've just produced.
Yes. So there's, actually that's a good question, whether or not they should read what they've produced during the moment of writing. They should certainly set aside time so that the 27-minute writing moment includes familiar and predictable tasks. For many people, that means that near the end of the writing session, they will have what looks like a paragraph. And what I recommend they do, actually, is exactly what you say, is that they read it out loud. That if in some situations, depending on where you're writing, that might be not possible for you. Certainly read it through, maybe even read it sort of out loud, but in the back of your throat, kind of like really just mumble, move your lips, yeah, mumble through it, right? Because it does focus your attention on what you've produced. A good piece of writing should be easy to read out loud, right? So that's one of the things you should do is read it. Some people will then move that, they'll decide, well, it's kind of disappointing to do it right at the end because I don't have time to fix anything. So they'll end up having a rhythm that is more like writing for 15 minutes, reading for 2 minutes, and then working on it again. But because the important thing is when you reach 27 or 18 minutes, whatever you've planned, that you have to stop, right? The important thing is to plan your work in such a way that that doesn't become predictably unpleasant, right? You should learn to use the time so that when you get to the last 3 minutes, you're doing the kinds of things that you want to be doing at the end, right? So you're teaching yourself how to dispose of that moment, right? But I really do leave it very much up to people how they do it themselves. And so one thing to be really clear about there is that being in doubt or being bored is part of the suffering of writing and not a reason to do something else, like check your email, like go read something because you think, oh, I don't know enough about this, I should go read something. No, you've decided to sit there and be bored or in doubt with this. It's your own fault because you decided what you were going to do, right? And so next time maybe make a better decision, but don't give yourself the out of going to do something else. This is the task you set yourself.
I think we have to close mm-hmm. this round. And I think we should, we will of course come back to lots of these things Great. In the next sessions. But I want to ask you a question is whether, because we've talked about academic writing, and I would like to ask you the question of whether academic writing is this quirky thing that we learn just for the university.
Yep.
What's your point of view on that?
Yeah. There's two answers to that question, at least. And one of them is that academic writing is actually a special form of writing. And it is, if you say just for university, I might be able to grant that. It's certainly not just for students, though, right? It's for communicating among academics, which is to say people who are people who are learning something mainly for the sake of knowing it, not for the sake of saving the world, not for the sake of getting wealthy, of all the kinds of projects that you can have with knowledge. Now, of course, some of the people watching this, some of the students, are at school in order to learn something, in order to get out there and do something, right? We just have to remember that while we're at school, we're only here to learn it for the sake of learning it, for the sake of knowing it. We want to become good at knowing, right? Which means being good at holding a belief with an awareness that other people hold other beliefs and that we have to be able to critically engage with them. So in that sense, academic writing is a specific kind of specialized skill. But being able to know something academically because it requires you to be able to compose a coherent prose paragraph, but it means that a good academic knower is also somebody who has strong writing skills, strong argumentation skills, and those generalize. So they can be used for other things as well. So in that sense, it's not a specific thing. What is really, really, really specific is that you are not communicating something that you are the sole authority on, right? So you're not communicating personal experience. You are not communicating something that you have any particular authority sort of about, as one would if one is a politician who has a mandate to say something, if one is an official, that you have a certain official power to say certain things, or just if you're the CEO of a company, saying certain things obviously makes them true in the sense that you've just declared them to be the policy, right? So that kind of thing is not what you're doing. And this is an important thing, this one is hard, right? To make sure that you don't think of academic writing as the sort of thing you read in your textbooks. You would think that textbooks would be full of academic writing. The problem is that a textbook is written by somebody who knows something, for the purpose of teaching it to somebody who doesn't know it. So it doesn't have that intellectual equality to it. So properly speaking, it's not academic writing, which is a hard one to get your mind around sometimes, but it's an important one to get your mind around. And then there's, you said quirky, right? Certainly the quirkiest kind of writing that we can think of would be literary writing, poetry, this kind of thing. So the domain where we experiment with language and with writing is literature. The important thing there is that you're writing from one person to another person, an individual, and you are writing, many novelists will say, I'm really just writing for myself or something, right? Like they'll say that that's the only standard that they're playing to, is they want to write something they would find interesting themselves. And of course, that's not true of academic writing. You're really thinking very much about your reader. Virginia Woolf put it very poignantly. She said that's not entirely true. She said of two of her characters in one of her novels, she said that they understood the loneliness that is the truth of things. And so they have this beautiful moment where they share the loneliness that is the truth of things. Right? Literary critics have been good at pointing this out, that that's actually a good way of understanding what a novel does. Right? It shares between reader and writer the loneliness that is the truth of things. That's a very quirky literary approach to writing, and academic writing is the opposite, right? Academic writing is the truth that you can have a conversation about, right? It is very much a conversation. It's not a lonely business at all, right? When you are writing academically, you are explicitly trying to converse and share, and you are sharing with somebody that you presume has similar experiences and is part of a community, right? So that would be my very, very, very strong separation between literature and academic writing.
Right. Okay, thank you, Thomas, for the session. It's been great.
Anytime.
Let's close it off.
Yes.
All right, thank you.
Okay.